Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Movie Geeks United special uncut interview series for the McCabe and Mrs. Miller tribute show. On this episode, actor Corey Fisher. First of all, tell me about your first encounter with Robert Altman. Were you doing experimental theater at the time, if I'm not incorrect?
Yes. I was in Los Angeles. I was doing improvisation with a group called The Committee, which was an improvisational company from San Francisco that had come down to start a second company in L.A. They were very influenced by the whole Second City Chicago school of improv, which has been so influential since then, with the whole large number of actors on Saturday Night Live who came out of Second City in later generations. And this was much earlier, of course, in 1969. The committee came down and started a group in L.A., which I joined as a student, really, at first in their workshops, and then became an understudy, and eventually we started, some of us started a group of our own that spun off and lasted 3 years, and one of the members of that group, Gary Austin, later went on to found the Groundlings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, became a very important group later on, which always kind of surprised me. Never expected that to happen. But Altman was looking for actors who had experience as improvisers. I had gone to UCLA with an amazing character, a wonderful guy named Leon Erickson, who was Altman's art director for a number of films, I think including his very first film, Cold Day in the Park, before Matt, a Canadian film with, what was her name, the actress?
We just talked about this yesterday. I can't remember.
Strangely, what I remember about her was I think she only had one eye.
Sandy Dennis. Yeah.
No. Okay. Yeah, it's Sandy Dennis. I don't know if I'm correct about the eye. Anyway, Leon. Really digressing, but Leon Erickson introduced me. He told Bob, I guess, about me, because Leon knew I was working with the committee, and I was called in for an interview, no auditioning, just hung out for a few minutes, talked to him, and the next day I got a call that I was hired. And up to then I'd only done, maybe a couple of really forgettable TV shows and a really horrible movie. It was actually a motorcycle movie, you know, in the days when they made that genre of really awful motorcycle movies, biker movies.
Yeah.
And this was the one I was in was one of the all-time worst. So this was very exciting to me. of course, to get that job. And I met people then who I'm still in touch with. So it was MASH was an incredible experience.
Oh, it had to have been, yeah.
Yeah, and then Robert asked me to be in Brewster McCloud, his next film, which took me to Houston, my first time in Texas, for about 8 weeks, playing a Houston cop, of all things, very much against type. And that was a very interesting experience. The film, I guess, became kind of a cult item. You know, a lot of people really didn't like it. It's a very odd movie.
Yeah.
I don't think Bob really felt that it worked the way he hoped it would. And then while we were doing that, he gave me the script as it then was for McCabe. At the time, it had a very odd title. It was called The Presbyterian Church Wager. Because the town, which I think is still the case in the film, the name of the town is Presbyterian Church. The settlement that they're making there.
Yeah.
And the script was based on a book called McCabe, a Western, I guess, a Western novel. And the thing about Bob Altman, though, was whatever you saw in the script, you kind of got to understand after working with him for a while, that anything you saw in a script was guaranteed not to wind up in the film, or probably it probably wouldn't even get shot.
Yeah.
Because especially a script that existed before production had even started, that was simply a rough guide for casting more than anything, because the actual script was sort of hammered out day by day mainly between Robert and Warren Beatty.
Mm.
Warren Beatty had a huge role in shaping that film. He was, of course, a co-producer, and he was very passionately involved, and of course Julie Christie and he were a couple at the time. And so he was much more than simply an actor coming in to do a job. He was he and Bob really collaborated, I think.
Yeah, and one of his best performances, I think.
Yeah,
certainly.
Yeah.
Tell me, you mentioned improvisation and his search for actors that were capable of that. That was an important quality that he looked for in his actors generally, or was it just for that one project in MASH?
No, it was always, I mean, including McCabe and I think pretty much all his films ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And what, now, you know, it improvisation is very misunderstood a lot. I mean, it's really a spectrum, you know. I think every performance, whether it's on film or in the theater, on television, every performance has some degree of improvisation in it. And every performance has some degree of preparation in it. So it's always a question of how much improv in relation to how much preparation. And on one extreme, you have, you know, pretty much full-out improv, which I've done a lot of in the theater, where you really have nothing prepared. You maybe work with a suggestion from the audience or not. Some forms of it simply start with sound and movement, and you see what images start arising, and it all comes from that moment to moment, which can be very exciting, very, very scary, and a very fruitful way of working. And then there's the kind of the Second City style of improv. Ultimately was very much written from improv. They would start working on an idea for a scene, a sketch, and they would improvise it in the sense of that the dialogue wasn't written, but the the plot in a way. The characters were probably given, you know, in front. So there was that kind of preparation. And gradually over time, the language became set. And ultimately what they wound up with was a sketch, a written sketch that would become part of a set show where they, you know, usually the early show was the set show where they would just run their sketches. And then there'd be a late show where they would be developing material. And that's how a lot of stand-up comics work. They'll try out stuff in front of an audience and keep shaping it and refining it, adding to it, cutting it, and eventually it becomes a set piece.
Yeah.
Now, in film, again, there's a huge range. What Bob liked to do was, because he was so interested in creating a world and then going in and filming it almost the way a documentary filmmaker would, he liked to have a whole crew, a stable of actors, his posse kind of, who would inhabit this world and know how to contribute to the creation of this world without having to be told or what to do or have things written for them. So he'd be setting up the scene, say, in MASH, where there's an actual written scene between, you know, Hawkeye and Trapper going on. But he then tells three or four of us who are playing other doctors in the tent, say, hanging out, he says, go, I want you guys to be talking about, you know, how drunk you got the night before and what happened. And so we would go off and kick it around and sort of come up with a loose scenario for some dialogue. And he'd listen to it and say, great. And then while the main scene was going on, he'd have us doing our dialogue in the background. And a lot of it would overlap. And he didn't always shoot in the traditional way of doing a master shot and then close-ups. He would often try to do things in one take with the camera moving. He kind of pioneered what they now call the walk and talk kind of shot they used to do a lot on West Wing.
Right.
Where the camera keeps moving and actors move in and out of the shot as the scene progresses, which is very hard to do. It really requires ensemble work, teamwork between the crew and the actors. It's almost like filming a live event. And that's how he liked to do it. So he liked to create many layers of activity.
That's what makes his film so unique, and that's obviously one of Altman's signatures. And watching McCabe and the rest of his films, you feel like that town has been there before the camera started rolling. And every scene, you feel like there's life in that scene before Warren Beatty walks into the frame. You know,
There was. He was very. He put a lot of energy into making that the case. In fact, you know, again, Leon Erickson, the art director, brought in entire buildings from the prairies, from the plains in Canada, old farm buildings that they found in God knows where, Calgary area, and actually, you know, I don't know, disassembled them enough to be able to move them and then rebuilt them on what was essentially some empty ground that was waiting to be developed in North Vancouver that he was able to get for the shoot. And of course, it happened to be a winter with those incredible heavy snows. All that was real. And but for months before the actors arrived, they were building this town. And then a lot of the carpenters they hired, you know, in those days, there were a lot of hippie carpenters hanging around Vancouver and the Northwest, and they were delighted to just be able to stay there on this in this town they'd built and actually live there for a while.
Wow.
And that's what they did. So every there were no false fronts. Every building was a practical building with people living in it. And cooking and, you know, carrying on their life. It was sort of like, it was kind of like a be-in that they used to have in the 60s, you know, that kind of event or a Renaissance fair. It was that sense of this community that was created that was almost independent of the fact that there was a film being made.
It's spoken about a lot that Altman enjoyed taking an accepted genre and deconstructing it in a way, and this McCain became known as a kind of anti-Western. I'm wondering,
right.
did you get that sense when you were working on it that this was a completely new direction to take this genre?
Yes. Yes. I mean, we knew it was a new direction, for sure. Now, whether or not at the time, I don't know. I couldn't say that I was aware that he was deconstructing the Western, because that requires a kind of almost hindsight and a perspective and a knowledge that I was a young dude back then. I was in my early 20s, and I don't know that I knew that much about film history to really get all that. Certainly not, you know, back when we did MASH, we didn't know what we were doing, you know, in a sense. Which was great, because they left us alone. They left Bob alone, you know. Nobody, he was like the 23rd director they had offered that script to for MASH.
Was everyone afraid? Was everyone afraid of it because of
nobody,
the war?
Or they didn't? I don't know. Maybe, or they just didn't get it. And again, and it always to me it was ironic that it was Ring Lardner Jr. who wound up getting an Oscar for that, right? For the screenplay, because he, casting no aspersions on him as a writer. The film that was shot was not the script he wrote. You know, there were so many rewrites on the set. Not that people were improvising on camera, but often the scene would be rewritten, reworked during rehearsals. Now, minutes before it would get shot, which is the way, you know. Sometimes some directors work entirely by the script. You know, they don't want you to change a word. Some TV shows, you absolutely cannot change a word as it comes down. I a few years ago, I did one of the last episodes of Frasier, and on a show like Frasier, you know, off with your head if you dare mess with a syllable, because those writers, you know, they have spent hours crafting this, and they know the characters and the setup and the style, and you know, it's a tight ship. But with the kind of filmmaking that Bob did, it was all being created in the moment. Really. And there was no, you know, now I would say he was really a postmodernist in the sense of he didn't work vertically. There wasn't this vertical hierarchy of, you know, the writer sits there and crafts this artifact that is the script that is then handed down the next stop to the director, who then hands it down to the crew and the cast who make it happen, and everything is set according to the upper level, what's handed down to you. It's more horizontal. Mm. It's like everyone is contributing at different times, maybe, but everything, you know, in that kind of postmodern view, working on the horizontal, everything becomes worthy of exploration.
Yeah.
You don't take anything for granted. You don't pretend to know what is the most important element in a scene.
Yeah.
And that's why he would go for this density. And maybe then in the editing room, this little throwaway that one of us more background characters was doing might actually get used. Sometimes something would emerge from one of these improvisations that would really, inspire Bob maybe to build something that he hadn't thought of.
And
Bruce to McLeod, I know, with a whole relationship in the film between me and another character, minor characters, and he created a whole subplot that wasn't in the script.
Wow.
That is in the movie. And it was actually the only time I can remember actually improvising cold on camera. He just set it up. It was in an amusement park on a boat ride in Houston. And my character, this Houston police sergeant, was on a date with the widow of one of the victims. And he told me to just talk to her, and that she couldn't say anything. And he said, he just told me to keep talking nonstop for the length of the ride about anything I wanted. And then he said, action, roll them. And the ride started. We were on this boat in this, you know, fake river jungle ride. And so I did it. You know, I came up with this whole little scenario about some getaway cabin in Galveston I wanted to take her to. And it wound up in the film. Yeah.
You know, but I get that sense watching his movies that process would kind of mutate and it would be an ongoing sense of discovery, because with a movie like McCabe, it feels like it's a living thing. And
yeah.
I'm wondering, as a director, you've obviously worked with so many directors since Altman, looking back at him, what made him unique? How did he direct you? What was his technique?
Well, what was unique is he invited you into the process. Again, it's that horizontal thing I'm talking about. He didn't look at actors as kind of, some directors, you know, don't really like actors so much.
Mm-hmm.
They're like a necessary evil. Some love actors, but are much more interested in the image they're projecting. Bob saw the actor as a creative partner, as someone who knew as much or more about the character than anyone,
yeah,
the writer or the director. And so he wanted to know what you thought and felt, and if what was written didn't feel right to you, he'd want to know why or what else, what's the alternative. So there was that sense of inclusion, that nobody is just a cog in the wheel.
Yeah.
Or a cog in the machine. What else? Well, so many directors don't pay any attention to the actors, really, unless they're really doing something awful.
Mm-hmm.
But they're really, all their energy and attention is going into the look, continuity, shaping the film,
yeah,
and just assuming the actor is going to do what's required, that they're going to be professional enough to understand what's needed scene by scene. And, you know, they'll give directions like, no, you've got to stand a few inches off this way. You're in the way of somebody's light. Or, you know, I want more energy here. Or, you know, kind of result-oriented direction.
Yeah.
Rather than process type work. So
he loved the characters above all else. He said he really cared more about the characters than the story. He said, I don't care much about story. And so I would think that his primary focus would be the actors,
Although, you know, I think in a way that's a kind of a false dichotomy because the story emerges from character. And character is created by events. A character to me, and I think to Bob, was never a fixed thing, an unchanging entity. We're one person to our lover. We're a totally different person with our father. We're yet another person when we're, you know, a patient in a dentist chair, you know. We change so much depending on who we're relating to and what situation we're in. And that was another reason why the whole milieu, the environment, the ambiance was important, because character doesn't exist in isolation. Character is part of a larger context.
I'm wondering about your experience of seeing the movie, when you actually saw the finished product. It's such a magical film. Did it surprise you, its power, having been involved in it?
Well, frankly, it took me a long time to really get to the point where I could really see it and experience it the way, or even close to the way, someone who hadn't been involved would.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a large chunk of my life, you know, living in this house in North Vancouver, very close to the set. For me, there was an element of disappointment in that experience, because in the script that Bob gave me in Houston, the character he wanted me to do, Reverend Elliot, this insane minister,
mm-hmm.
was really a very central role. And there was a lot of material. I mean, he never talked much. In fact, he hardly spoke, which was part of the strength of the character. But there were a number of encounters between McCabe and this guy where McCabe would be trying to rattle him and get a rise out of him, and the guy would just stonewall him, you know, kind of maintain his strange, withdrawn madness.
Yeah.
And most of those scenes never got shot. That, you know, that's what I was alluding to when I said if you know, I learned that if you saw something too early in the process written down, there was a good chance it would never get used. And that's what happened in a way that, for me personally, was disappointing. And probably it was a very good move for the film, that as it emerged, it was part really of a whole different conception. So so the experience was strange, being up there for 13 weeks. And probably out of 13 weeks, there were maybe 5 days where I was really working a lot.
Yeah.
There would be day after day after day when I would never be on camera, never work, you know, which was true for a lot of us. And we'd be hanging out in the trailers. The fun part was a lot of us made music. There were a lot of guitar players and songwriters, I still know a guitar instrumental that we composed, a bunch of us composed together during those long days of waiting in the trailers. And then, of course, there would be some days where, you know, those handful of days where suddenly, you know, it was very exciting and compelling and being right in the middle of it. But it didn't turn out to be, for me as an actor, the kind of experience I imagined it was going to be in a lot of ways. So there was an element of disappointment there, I have to be honest.
Yeah.
Years later, of course, as I saw the film again and again with some distance, I became, you know, much more open to it and could really appreciate it for itself, not as part of my life.
Right.
Or some, you know, those associations sort of cooled off after a while.
Yeah, I understand that, but it seems like the movie lovers at large, the film community, film fan community, it wasn't so much appreciated upon its release, but as the years have gone by, it's kind of gained in its stature.
Yeah,
and people love it.
Yeah.
Have you found that when people approach you and
yes.
you discover? Yeah.
Well, I never run into anyone who didn't like it, who doesn't like it.
Yeah.
Whenever people, you know, whenever I meet someone new and we wind up talking about our lives and what have you done, what did you do, and whenever I mention that I was in that, they say, my God, really? Who are you? Oh, that's one of my favorite films. Where were you? Who were you? And they when I tell them, and of course the irony is the thing everybody remembers is the scene where the preacher plants the cross on top of the church, right?
Yeah.
Against the sun, setting sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible shot. So he climbs up the spire with this huge cross. And that wasn't me. That was the stunt guy.
Wow.
And I felt bad because Bob really wanted me to do it. And he tried so hard to convince me it was safe. But I have had a lifelong fear of heights.
Oh, yeah. I don't blame you.
He got me on stilts for Brewster McCloud for the credits, the closing credits. And Brewster McCloud, he staged an entire circus with all the actors, all the characters reappearing as circus characters.
Mm-hmm.
And he put me in an Uncle Sam suit on stilts. And so every day I was practicing in the Astrodome, walking on stilts, because even 3 feet of elevation like that, I found very challenging.
And you're very tall already, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm 6'7".
Wow.
And
wow.
I don't like heights. You know, my son and wife are big rock climbers, you know. I don't go near that. I love scuba diving. I have no problem with depth. As long as there's a lot of water to hold me up, I'm fine. But
yeah,
that chance, yeah. So I didn't want to. I tried getting partway up just to check it out, and I felt the thing swaying in the wind, you know, this wooden tower. And I said, no, really, I can't.
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask about the Traveling Jewish Theater.
You're
the co-founder of that.
Of course.
You still do work with them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a company I founded 30 years ago, a little longer than that, actually. We're one of the few surviving mid-size experimental theaters from, you know, that era, late 70s. We have our own space in San Francisco.
Mm.
Our website is atjt.com, TJT for Traveling Jewish Theater,
mm-hmm.
with an A in front of it, atjt.com. We're in the middle of a season right now. I just closed in a performance, in a play that I was performing in. I'm not in the next one, but the theater, against all odds, is doing fine. We went through a big crisis last spring, almost had to close. We sort of were a little ahead of the curve in terms of the meltdown, but our community and a number of private foundations, because like all nonprofit theater, we depend on support like that.
Yeah.
If we had to make it just from ticket sales, we would have to charge a couple hundred dollars a ticket, because we have a 90-seat theater. So like almost all theater in America requires a subsidy, and it's right now, of course, a very hard time.
Yeah.
And we had to work very hard, all artists in this country. Just a couple of weeks ago, I don't know how many people know this, but in the stimulus package, one of the Republican senators put an amendment in there to forbid any of that money going to any kind of artist or art institution. Can you believe that? An actual amendment that said no money should go to any museums, any theaters, any film festivals, because who needs to give money to artists? That's not going to help the economy, which is simply ignorant, because, in fact, the arts are a huge stimulus to any economy.
Yeah.
And fortunately, a group, Americans for the Arts, managed to get enough action going that amendment did not go through. It was defeated.
Well, thank God for that.
And it wound up, the National Endowment for the Arts, for the first time in many years, actually is now getting some extra money through the stimulus. And they'll be able to put that money to work right away. It'll come right back into the economy. They should be doing, of course, a lot more. And I was hoping for another federal theater project that of the kind that existed in the 30s that FDR started. It was part of the New Deal. And the Federal Theater Project did amazing work. People need to know that history.
Will we ever see a national theater?
I don't know. Before that will happen, I think there unfortunately is a real kind of a historical tendency in America to that's kind of part of an anti-intellectual, anti-art sentiment. It's almost a fear of it, or maybe it comes out of this sort of exaggerated, distorted view of the free market, that art should compete in the marketplace.
Right.
But art is different. Art is not part of that monetary economy in a lot of ways. It's part of what I would call a gift economy, which I didn't make up. There's an amazing book called The Gift by Lewis Hyde, H-Y-D-E, that talks about this idea. And the budget of any small, a mid-sized theater in a mid-sized town in Germany is bigger than the entire budget of our National Endowment for the Arts.
Mm.
One small theater, well, I mean, mid-sized theater in a normal town, gets more money than is given by our government, the national government, to the entire country. Most state arts councils have collapsed entirely since the NEA was denied funding, it started during the Clinton years, the so-called culture wars.
Yeah.
The NEA was attacked. So a national theater, I don't know. I think what perhaps would be even more interesting would be to have many different national theaters, regional theaters.
Right.
Of course, there's the regional theater movement, which isn't really that regional. Now they call it more the resident theater movement. The theaters, the major theaters in each city on, that sort of are on the level of the symphony or the... Now, where are you actually located?
I personally am in Florida.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. You know, and you said that it stimulates the economy, and it certainly does. It stimulates everything, though. I mean, I get very passionate about the theater and the kind of the lack of culture that we're suffering from now, because it's integral to the community. I mean, it can seep into the marrow of the community. It's very important to have community theater, I think.
It's important that arts be part of education
from
an early age. You know, unfortunately, we're losing audiences for theater and for live art, I think, because there is no preparation for it, you know.
Yeah.
In cities where there's a vital children's theater, like Minneapolis, for example, you tend to have a very vital theater community, which is true in Minneapolis, and I believe the same in Chicago. San Francisco has no, where I'm located, there is no real children's theater. And the theater scene in San Francisco is not what it used to be, because everyone's getting older, and there's no, there are no young people, or not, there are fewer young people coming up in to be the new audience. So a lot of us are really focused on that and doing whatever outreach we can to the schools and to teachers and to young people. With Traveling Jewish Theater, we now have really a new generation of leaders running the company now, which has been very exciting. You know, I'm 63. I was 33 when we started. Our new artistic director, who's not so new, 6 years he's been doing it, Aaron Davidman is just turned 40 and, you know, is really taken on the mission of creating theater, really dynamic, interesting, relevant, contemporary theater that is somehow connected to Jewish sources, but is in no way a parochial isolated theater.
Right.
And in fact, we are discussing changing the name, and probably will at some point, to indicate that it's more inclusive than it may sound with the current name. And also there's the fact that we don't travel the way we used to.
Right.
We used to mainly be a touring company in the 70s and 80s, but now we're really a resident company in San Francisco.
Well, I want you to come back anytime you'd like, and we'll talk more about acting, and just bless you for the theater work and for all the efforts you've made on that front, and for sharing your stories about Altman and McCabe. I appreciate it so much.
Oh, I'd love to. By the way, can I just mention my own website?
Yes.
Like my name, it's just coreyfisher.com with a CoreyFisher. And I've got links to all kinds of projects, a short film that I did with my son, who's a filmmaker, an up-and-coming filmmaker, and we did a little project together that I wrote and acted in. And there's some writings of mine and various things about creativity and, you know, a lot of what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's a great site. We're going to post it up on our chat room and spell it out during the show, because it is a great site and really a lot of inspiring stuff there. Corey, thank you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I'm so glad you're doing this.
Thank you.
You know, there's hope in the, you know, what's happening with the net, no question.
I think so, too. Yeah.
I mean, it can go lots of different ways, but... I see lots of positive stuff, and the whole world of webisodes, I think, has a huge potential if the producers will just be willing to pay us, us actors, and give us residuals, for heaven's sake.
Oh yeah, that's a battle right there. Yeah.
Oh man, I could we could do a whole other show on what's going on with Screen Actors Guild and what is going on. I'm a member, but I'm very confused.
I don't know. Someone's making money off of it. They have to determine where that money's coming from, who's getting it, and how to divvy it out.
Yeah.
Because I appreciate it so much, Corey. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Jamie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.